You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
It may well be as we head into a whole new era. 1 year, of course, since we had the ramifications of a president of the United States who was a reality TV star. Finn Pollard, always a delight to assist in the technological stuff of Past Prologue. We may have 3 fabulous folk in this particular programme. It may just be your good self and one other.
Yes, we hope to be joined down the line from Alabama later on in the programme by Darren Harris-Fain from Auburn University, but we're just grappling with a slight technical
It's a way forward, and we'll work through it. But in the studio we have
Dr. David Hughes from the School of International Relations, who is an expert on American foreign policy.
And we'll find out more from David and your good self and reflections on Trump 1 year on after this.
Thank you.
was, I hope, a familiar tune to many listeners, and I'm delighted to say I hope that in the course of that tune we have managed to make telephonic contact with Dr. Darren Harris-Fain at Auburn University in Montgomery, Alabama. Darren, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Brilliant. I can hardly hear you. I think this is... anyway, we shall carry on. So, I thought it would be particularly interesting to connect up again a little over a year after we were sharing the Siren Studio, talking about the on the eve of the US presidential election last year, because of the particular political events going on in Alabama just at the moment. And I thought it might be interesting to start by talking a little bit about the Alabama as a state and its politics. So perhaps we could start there.
Okay. Alabama, of course, is in the deep south here in the U.S., and it, of course, was one of the states that seceded from the Union and helped to form the Confederate States of America. That, more than anything, has shaped Alabama's political history since the mid-19th century. And at the time, Alabama was pretty much a Democratic state, and the newly formed Republican Party was seen very much as the enemy of their way of life, especially since the major cog in their political platform, their machine, was abolition. And so during that time, of course, the Democratic Party reigned in Alabama, and it continued to reign for quite some time. The Democratic Party in the 19th century was seen initially as the party in support of slavery and eventually the party of Jim Crow, whereas the Republican Party was seen as the abolitionist party and being more progressive. However, since that time, in the 20th century, both parties evolved into more or less the opposites of what they were in the 19th century, so that the Democratic Party was eventually seen as the more progressive liberal party, and the Republicans became the more conservative party here in the States.
And obviously, I was looking back at the history, that also began to involve some Democrats switching over to Republican status, most notably, I suppose, I think it was Richard Shelby. Do you think that were there other specific factors that then also led to strong support for Trump in the most recent election?
Very much so, and those have to do with the shift of Alabama from being a predominantly Democratic state to a predominantly Republican state. A lot of that has to do with the strong hold that evangelical Protestant Christianity still has in Alabama. As the Democrats became more and more identified with social liberalism and the Republicans with social conservatism, the Republicans definitely drew on that evangelical vote and presented themselves as the party of family values, traditional values, and especially as conservative Alabamians were alarmed by things like the rise of feminism, by increasing social liberalism when it comes to civil rights issues or even religious issues. They increasingly saw the Democrats as antithetical to their worldview and the Republicans as those who supported it or at least claimed to be supporting that. So definitely many conservative Alabamians saw Hillary Clinton as the embodiment of all of those social liberal attitudes and beliefs that they found abhorrent. And despite some things in his personal life, they saw Trump as at least giving lip service to their worldview. So that's part of it. I think the other part has to do with the idea that they value, conservative Alabamians do, they value the idea of self-sufficiency, self-reliance. You don't rely on the government to help you. And they look with disdain at the kind of people that Ronald Reagan in the 1980s called welfare queens, people living off government assistance but living perhaps better lives than they do. Some of that has to do with some of the economic stagnation that America has experienced in recent decades. People who are working low-paying jobs, paying their taxes, feeling like they're not relying on the government, and people who are doing better than them. So there's also that they see Republicans as wanting to scale back government support for people in different situations, and hopefully aspire then to the middle class, this idea of trickle-down economics that is currently being revived with the tax plan that's floating around in Congress right now.
There's a number of things that I think it's interesting to pick up on there, and the first one is this, what can appear a kind of contradiction between an evangelical belief in traditional family values and then the willingness to overlook some of Trump's more problematic aspects in relation to that. And similarly, of course, what seems to be the willingness to overlook, at least it's still an ongoing investigation, but the accusations levelled at Roy Moore, the candidate in the upcoming Senate election. Is the contradiction between those two positions as big as it can appear, or are there explanations around the sort of particular nature of evangelical Christianity in Alabama?
I think there are two approaches that I have seen people in the state take to that. One is, along with a distrust of government and even with what they see as the establishment Republicans who are part of the problem they perceive, is a distrust of media. Especially the more traditional mainstream media outlets, newspapers such as the Washington Post, which of course broke the Roy Moore story, and the New York Times, with television outlets such as the major networks and CNN. You can actually see people with bumper stickers here in Alabama that say, "I don't believe the liberal media." And so Donald Trump has downplayed or denied the allegations against him. And Roy Moore, of course, has done the same. And there are some people who are willing to believe him on that, saying, "Well, the media is just making this up, trying to discredit our candidate." And then the other thing is that some people might actually believe Roy Moore may have been involved with teenagers when he was in his 30s and sexually abused or assaulted some of them. But they might say, "Well, our culture is different. You know, teenagers can marry. Loretta Lynn, you know, the well-known country singer, she married at 14. One of our state officials actually tried to pass off the story by saying, "Well, you know, Joseph was an adult and Mary was a teenager when they had Jesus, and so it's okay." So there's that kind of thinking. There was even an ad in the Montgomery newspaper that a citizen paid for, quoting Jesus from the Gospel of John, saying, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone."
So I suppose there's also that element of the born again to it as well, that even if you have sinned, that sin can be in some way forgiven.
Right, and of course that is exactly what Bill Clinton did. I think Bill Clinton managed to get people back on his side who he didn't entirely alienate by presenting himself as a sinner. "I have sinned." That's the language that Clinton put it in.
Midnight in
Montgomery, Silver Eagle, Lonely Road. I was on my way to Mobile for a big New Year's Eve show. I stopped for just a minute, see a friend outside of town. Put my collar up, I found his name, felt the wind die down. And a drunk man in a cowboy hat took me by surprise, wearing shiny boots, a nudie suit, and haunted eyes. He said, friend, it's good to see you, it's nice to know you care. Then the wind picked up, he was gone. Was he ever really there? 'Cause it's midnight in Montgomery, just hear that whippoorwill, see the stars light up the purple sky, feel that lonesome chill. 'Cause when the wind is right, you hear his song, smell whiskey in the air. Midnight in Montgomery, he's always singing there. Well, I climbed back on that eagle, one last look around. Red tail lights, shadow moves slow across the ground. Off somewhere, a midnight train slowly passing by. I could hear that whistle blow. I'm so lonesome I could cry. 'Cause it's midnight in Montgomery, just hear that whippoorwill, see the stars. Night in Montgomery, he's always singing there. He's always singing there. Oh, Hank's always singing there.
That was Alan Jackson's Midnight in Montgomery, in honour of our guest down the line from that city. And Darren's going to stay with us, but we're just going to turn for a few minutes now in the next segment to talk with my colleague here in the studio, David Hughes. And I wanted to start by asking you, David, one of the things that Trump made a big sort of part of his campaign last year was this idea of draining the swamp. In Washington, I suppose, getting rid of all the corruption and so on. To what extent do you think he's made that a reality?
Well, thanks for inviting me on, Fenn. You're absolutely right. This was one of the centrepieces of Trump's election campaign. And moreover, in his inauguration speech back in January, it was one of the most extraordinary inauguration speeches I've seen, surrounded by the Washington establishment, former presidents and others. He reiterated this vow to drain the swamp, and he promised that he would, and I quote, take power from the Washington elite and return it to ordinary people. Now, what was surprising, perhaps, about this is almost as he's saying these words, he was staffing his cabinet with billionaires and generals, the exact opposite of what he'd promised. Furthermore, in his first budget, there were some quite vicious attacks on healthcare, education, culture and so forth. And this accompanied a dramatic increase in military spending, I think $56 million or so. So you could see this as a full frontal attack, actually, on the working class, despite all of the rhetoric. And I think that's just one of many continuities that we've seen between the Obama and the Trump administrations.
What most struck out for me, actually, in that regard, was that extraordinary story about the Puerto Rican electricity supply being taken over by the, I think it was a small company from Montana that had connections to the Interior Minister. But I very much see what you mean. So you were talking at the end there about the ideas of continuities from presidency to presidency. But at the same time, there are some obvious differences, and I think, you know, the tone of the inauguration speech might be one of them, where there's an obvious contrast with Obama. But I want to move it specifically to the area of foreign policy, and hear some thoughts from you about the extent to which, how does the continuity contrast play out in that field?
Yes, I think we've seen continuities and discontinuities in foreign policy terms. It's important to separate the rhetoric from the actual practice of US foreign policy. If you ignore what Trump actually says and look at what he's actually done in terms of foreign policy, you see some quite striking continuities between administrations. For example, Trump has escalated Obama's wars in Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Somalia, and is also behaving increasingly aggressively towards North Korea and Iran. The Yemen case is particularly troubling. Over 12,000 civilians have been killed in that conflict, and the US, along with the UK for that matter, is supplying the military hardware to Saudi Arabia for that. Similarly, in terms of the bombings, Obama actually dropped one bomb every 20 minutes on average in 2016, which sounds and is terrible. Trump has actually increased that bombing rate. So we have some escalation of pre-existing quite negative tendencies. Now, what's interesting is that Trump ran on a platform of America First. It was essentially a nationalist and anti-globalist platform. But it's not really come to very much in foreign policy terms. If you look at the champions of that agenda, Michael Flynn was one. But he lost his position very quickly, quickly ousted as National Security Advisor. Steve Bannon, of course, was another, but he too was forced out in early April. So what we saw at that point was a quite insecure presidency, and that was the point at which Trump authorised the dropping of 59 Tomahawk missiles on Syria. And sure enough, at that point, the media was full of talking heads saying, oh, I think this is the moment at which Trump has finally become presidential. However, it's worth contrasting the fact that Trump authorized this attack on Syria with the tweets that he sent out in 2013 when Obama was contemplating doing the same. And he sent about one tweet a day, very adamantly opposed to President Obama behaving in this way. Nevertheless, he was quickly induced to behave in a very similar way himself.
Is that an indication, do you think, that he's been captured by the existing foreign policy establishment?
I think it is. I think it is. And again, there's a long historical precedent for this. If you go back to the end of the Cold War, for example, the 1992 Defence Planning Guidance proposed what it called a strategy for the precluding the emergence of any potential future global competitor. So this was an overtly globalist agenda. Zbigniew Brzezinski was quite open about the fact that for America, the chief political prize, geopolitical prize, is Eurasia. The Project for a New American Century in 2000 proposed a blueprint for maintaining US global preeminence. That's a quote. Dick Cheney in 2002 came out and said, I quote, the plan is for the United States to rule the world. So you can trace this all the way back to 1945 at least, or the famous national security document NSC 68 in 1950. This globalist agenda has been there for many decades. And I think what's interesting is that despite Trump's best attempts to rein it back in, despite everything negative that he's had to say about China and the globalization of production and bringing things back to America's shores, buy American, hire American, and so on. It's not really happened in foreign policy terms. In some ways, you almost wouldn't know that there'd been a change of administration.
Does that suggest that the presidency is actually not as powerful as we might still sort of think it is, and you know, we obviously attach enormous significance to both within and beyond the states to every presidential race, and yet if there are these sort of continuities, and I suppose one almost thinks that old term, the military industrial complex, kind of actually determining perhaps how, you know, continuities of policy, that actually it isn't so relevant who occupies the office.
Thanks. Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think that you're right, actually. I was struck by a phrase that Julian Assange used when describing the president of the United States. And he referred to the president as an enabling cog, i.e. a figure who is at the centre of a vast complex of networks, as you say, the military-industrial complex being one, but all forms of big business. And helping those interests to coalesce. Noam Chomsky refers to the president as a mere figurehead, which may be taking it too far. So what I think is interesting is the way every election cycle produces narratives of, oh, this is so different from the last time. So, for example, George W. Bush was so different from Clinton because he represented unilateralism and not multilateralism. And Obama was so different from Bush because Bush was this terrible warmonger who got into Iraq and Guantanamo Bay, etc., and Obama vowed to change all of that and actually ended up keeping Guantanamo Bay open. And then we have it again with Trump. He's supposed to be so different from Obama, you know, so less sophisticated, cultured, you know, he's a misogynist brute and all the rest of it. But actually, U.S. foreign policy, I think, displays remarkable continuities across all four of those administrations.
On juicy fruit, red clay sticking to her Timberland boots, a tight white t-shirt showing off a Talladega tan. I said, darling, where you from? She said, watch your tongue, do you really have to ask? I'm from Alabama. And I'm a Bear Bryant fan. I can roll with the flow. Baby, you can roll with the tide. I don't mind if you do. I think it's kind of cute the way you say it with pride. When you say think it's kind of cute the way you say it with pride. Say it for me, baby.
I'm a freaking Bama. Baby, open up the can. I'm a freaking Bama.
Trace Adkins, Alla Freakin' Bama. And I want to come back now to you, Darren, who I hope is still loyally hanging on the other end of the telephone there. And I just wondered, first of all, whether there were any points that David made in the last segment that you wanted to comment on.
Yes. One thing I wanted to expand on a little bit is the role of the military in American globalization. That is another strong point in Trump's favor in the eyes of many Alabama conservatives. There is very strong support for the military. They cast the military's role in the world as protecting our freedom, as opposed to, say, protecting America's political and business interests around the world. And so Trump's support of the military actually doesn't seem to obviate the America First claims that he has put so much of his political stock in.
Would that also mean, I'll come across to you in a second, David, would that also mean, Darren, that it doesn't raise an issue in, for Trump supporters in Alabama, the number of sort of prominent military figures he's had in what we might usually think of as civilian positions?
No, if anything, I think they see that as a positive. They tend to see the military as disciplined role figures. Now, it is interesting that when Trump named his new chief of staff, there was a kind of sense of relief that he would bring a sense of discipline to the White House and curtail the importance of figures such as Jared Kushner, for instance. They tend to see the military not as politicians, but as outsiders like Trump. So that is kind of seen as a move to drain the swamp in a way.
Mm-hmm. And is, just because I don't know, is Alabama a state with a particularly strong connection to the military, locally?
Very much. In fact, there is an Air Force base right here on the outskirts of Montgomery, and there are other military bases in the state. So, yes, there is a very strong military presence here in Alabama.
David, did you want to come in on any of those points?
Sure. I think the military factor is extremely important. The United States has something approaching 1,000 military bases globally. They account for 95% of all foreign military bases. So it's very interesting to me the way that this can be sold to a conservative domestic audience within the United States as protecting freedoms. Of course, for many other people in the world, it's an overt sign of imperialism. So if you take the recent tensions with North Korea, there was a missile launch, not the one last night, but the one back in August by North Korea. And of course, the Western media was, forgive the pun, but up in arms about this. But what was not reported was that the United States and Japan had been conducting war games on the Japanese island of Hokkaido for 2 weeks straight before North Korea fired this missile over Hokkaido. And it was clearly not intended as an attack. It sailed straight over the island. The Japanese military didn't even try to shoot it down. So I think there's an important question of perspective to be raised here as to this military function.
I want to move back to something, Darren, that you were talking about in the very early on in the programme. You were mentioning the Civil War history in Alabama and the way that's informed politics there. And I was wondering to what extent any of the sort of effects from events that were happening in Charlottesville over the summer and the sort of broader way that Trump and other members of the administration have used particular ideas about Civil War history in their rhetoric, is that manifesting itself in Alabama in any particular way, or has the state managed to, not to be gripped by those tensions?
I have been surprised by how muted the response has been. And I think there are a couple of things going on there. For one thing, even though Alabama is not as ethnically diverse as other parts of the U.S., we do have a larger African-American population than many other states, in the neighborhood of 30% or so. And so, yes, you will occasionally see people around Alabama flaunting the Confederate flag, but you don't see quite the level of overt racism that has broken out in other parts of the country. It tends to be more muted, and I'm sure that African-American citizens here could give you stories of some of the racism they've actually encountered. I know it still goes on, but it's not as vocal as some of the expressions we have seen in places such as Charlottesville.
That must be a very positive thing for the state in a way, or in fact not in a way at all, just a relief. One of the other things that we were thinking about with relation to foreign policy in the course of the Trump campaign, indeed it's continued to overshadow the presidency since, is his relationship to the two, as it were, the two other major powers or aspirant major powers in the world, the Russians and the Chinese. And I wondered if you had thoughts about how that's, you know, to what extent has he managed to realise his campaign promises around those two nations?
Yeah, again, there's some very interesting things, I think, to be said here about continuity and discontinuity. He ran on a fairly realist platform vis-a-vis Russia, that he wouldn't try and bait conflict, as you were, with Russia. But what we've in fact seen has been increasingly aggressive rhetoric towards Russia. The never-ending accusations in the US media about the alleged Russian election hacking in 2016, for which I know of no credible evidence actually to back that up. But I think that there is perhaps an important discontinuity here between the administrations in terms of foreign policy. And it has to do with a story which is little reported in the mainstream media, and that is the waning of US petrodollar hegemony. So what do I mean by that? Well, back in the 1970s, the US reached a deal with Saudi Arabia whereby all oil sales would be priced in US dollars. Now, this has given the United States a tremendous economic advantage. It's made the US dollar the world's reserve currency, and it's essentially meant that where other countries have to manufacture goods and sell them in order to acquire the dollars to pay for oil, the United States can just simply print more money, as it has been doing. So this is a source of real power. Now, what we've seen over recent years, but especially over the last 12 months since Trump has been in charge, has been a real challenge to these arrangements on the part of Russia and China. So both of those countries have been buying up vast amounts of gold, possibly with a view to backing an alternative currency. China is now pressuring Saudi Arabia to begin selling oil in yuan. It could be that the yuan dollar is with us before we know it. Now, when Saddam Hussein stopped pricing oil in euros back in in 2000, and instead priced it in euros, it was about a year or two, not very long, until Iraq was invaded and Saddam Hussein was, of course, deposed. When Colonel Gaddafi in Libya proposed a gold-backed currency and challenges to the US international economic architecture, so too, it wasn't very long before he was deposed and regime change occurred. Now, last year, Iran began pricing oil in euros. And China and Russia are also threatening these arrangements. So it's concerning to think where this might go. Historically, it has led to military responses.
Oh,
With a quite unusual version of Kurt Vile's Alabama song. And I want to come back to Darren again. We were talking just before the music there about Trump and Russia. And of course, one of the things that has overshadowed the presidency is the investigation into ties between Russia and the Trump campaign and involvement in the alleged involvement in the actual election. And I was wondering to what extent that process is registering in Alabama. Is this another thing that is seen as fake news, or what sort of reaction is there?
I think the reaction is mixed. Some folks do indeed see it as fake news. They see it as the efforts of a liberal media trying to discredit the Trump administration. But I do think that some conservatives, including some Trump supporters, have been taken aback by the fact that this story is not going away, and that the investigation is actually finding some things, perhaps of substance. The ironic thing is that for many conservative Americans, Russia in their memory is the land of communism. And despite, you know, recent political changes in Russia, there is still some serious suspicion about Russia. And so I think some conservatives have been disturbed at the possibility that this is in fact true, that there was Russian involvement in the election.
And one of the other things that I was thinking about as we were talking, and I'm going to come to you first, Darren, and then back to David. We were talking in this business of differences, sort of continuities and change between the Obama presidency and the Trump presidency. And one of the things that has most sort of struck me, and I think that we were mentioning the inaugural address as perhaps particularly standing out in this regard, is the difference in tone that Trump adopts, the kind of tweeting, most obviously, but some of his public speeches and so forth, or at least it seems that way to me. And I was wondering again, in as it were, a state that is Trump heartland, at least in terms of the you know, the raw numbers of the result, how does that sort of register in terms of the way he interacts with the media and the way he addresses the public?
Again, I think the reaction is mixed. Some folks see this as exactly what they were voting for, somebody who was unfiltered, not politically correct, someone who would not bow to public interests in terms of saying the right thing or what is expected. And so some folks have celebrated that side of Trump. And again, I think others, including many conservatives, have been taken aback by the idea that he has not become more presidential, more professional, that he is not just saying what he thinks, but saying it in a mean-hearted way. This is especially probably the case, I would say, among many of the evangelical voters who voted for him, that he does not exhibit a sense of kindness and charity in his social media use.
Is there a... Would you say there's a sort of spectrum, and that perhaps at the moment there's still a fair willingness to forgive on the part of those voters, and that might shift over time, or do you think already people are moving beyond that to having less tolerance for it?
I think the latter is the case. Trump, of course, has already launched his re-election campaign for 2020. And I can see many Alabamians voting for him, but I honestly expect, and I think many conservatives are hoping, that he will be challenged for the Republican nomination and that he might not get it this time. I think that there is some sense of regret that he has not grown into the role and that nothing has changed.
Lazy days in mid-July, country Sunday mornings, dusty haze on summer highways, sweet magnolia calling. But now and then I find myself thinking of the days that we were walking in the Alabama rain. Driving movies Friday nights, drinking beer and laughing. Somehow things were always right, I just don't know what happened. But now and then I find myself thinking of the days when we were walking in the Alabama rain. Were only kids, but then I've never heard it said that kids can't fall in love and feel the same. I can still remember the first time I told you I love you on a dusty mid-July country summer's evening. A weeping willow sang its lullaby and shared our secret. But now and then I find myself thinking of the days that we were walking in the Alabama rain. Walking in the Alabama rain. Alabama rain.
Jim Kochet's, I'm pronouncing that right, Walking in the Alabama Rain. And I'd like to give you an opportunity, David, to comment on any of the points that Darren was just making before the music that that struck you.
Thanks, Ben. Yeah, I thought there were some really interesting points came up. One of them was to do with the perception that Russia is a communist country. Figures released just this week actually show that Russia is now the number one most socially unequal society in the world, followed by the United States in terms of inequalities of wealth. So since the capitalist restoration after 1989 or 1991, again, the reality doesn't match the rhetoric. On that note of perception management, one of the first rules of propaganda is to always accuse the other side of the very thing that you're guilty of. And I'm very interested by how relentless the accusations against Russia have been vis-a-vis the election hacking. Because again, in US foreign policy history, if one thing is known, it's that the US has routinely, over many decades, interfered in other countries' elections, even countries such as France in 2012, and also, of course, has staged any number of coups. So it's a useful kind of distraction mechanism. And finally, I'm interested in the rhetoric of fake news, which has been around a lot in the last 12 months. A law was quietly passed during Christmas 2016, which made it legal for companies like Google and Facebook to effectively exert a censorship function over their content. And we've seen that increasingly. So again, I think while the rhetoric is going in one direction, i.e. Russia fake news, all of this could in fact be a grand cover for the fact that these major tech firms are themselves becoming increasingly censorious. Google, for example, in April this year, began censoring any number of left-wing, anti-war and progressive websites. And I think it's important that people realise this.
So there's a number of things there that we could spend a lot of time thinking more about. And there's been quite a lot of commentary lately about the sort of role that the tech companies are playing in the economy and in the media. But we're running fast towards the end of another edition. So I want to come quickly back to Darren with a sort of final question, which is obviously the biggest, and we've alluded to this a bit, discussed it a bit earlier in the program, the biggest political story in the state at the moment is the special Senate election. And I just wonder, there have been one or two polls putting the Democrats ahead, but mostly, when I was looking today, Roy Moore is still up. Do you have a prediction as to which way it's going to go?
I think it is going to narrowly go to Doug Jones, and for this reason. First off, many people who find Roy Moore's views abhorrent found them abhorrent even before the allegations of his past. And so many people were not going to vote for him to begin with. And that includes some of my conservative friends that I've spoken to. They wanted Luther Strange in the seat, and they cannot see themselves voting for Roy Moore. So I think the conservatives are going to be split three different ways. Some will continue to vote for Moore. Others will write in a candidate. Even Richard Shelby, our senior senator in Alabama, has said he will not vote for Roy Moore. He is going to write a name in. And others will simply stay home. They could not bring themselves to vote for a Democrat, and so they'll simply stay home. And I think by that mixing of the people who might have voted for Moore, I think Doug Jones will get it.
We shall watch this space with interest. So we've come to the end of another edition of Past Prologue. I would like to thank both my guests, David Hughes here in the studio and Darren Harris-Ferrin, for joining us down the line from Alabama. It's been really fascinating to talk to you both about the ongoing phenomenon that is President Trump. I'd also like to thank, as ever, Alex Lefchuk for keeping us technically on the rails, and without which the programme would not happen. And we look forward to being back with you in about a month's time. Thanks for listening.
That it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
out, a new style is growing. But it don't know if it's coming.